This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, because our Main Street show today includes acknowledging the fact that we have a membership drive. And, you know, a couple times a year we remind our listeners that members make it possible for them to listen. So Ashley and I will cajole you toward the phone or toward the online service, or maybe using your phone to text us. However you want to get through to us to make your donation, you are very welcome to try.
And that phone number to call is 1-800-359-4145. The website, prairiepublic.org. Or if you want to text the word support to 484848, well, then you are on your way towards becoming or increasing or changing, what have you, your membership level here at Prairie Public. Why is it so important? Well, it's because we're not raising money by selling commercials, and so instead we're asking you to help make up that difference. We know you think we're worth it. People tune in specifically because what they want is that extra content that sometimes gets taken out of other pieces to air those commercials. So we give you that extra information, that little tidbit that just sticks with you. That's what you tune to public broadcasting for. And you can support that now by calling 1-800-359-4145, clicking and joining at prairiepublic.org, or by texting the word support to the number 48484848.
Now, it is called public radio, which means that, you know, it doesn't come from, there isn't some funding stream that comes pouring in toward Prairie Public from some public entity. Public is you. Public is not the government. It is you. We are member supported. So that's why we emphasize that we love our listeners, but the members make it possible for all of this listening to happen. So give us a call, 1-800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org, or that simple text, the word support to 484848, and then you'll get a link to make the donation that you think is appropriate. And we do come to you just a couple of times a year because it's vital. This is our funding stream. Membership support is the biggest slice of our budget pie. That's why it's important, if you have been mulling about this, thinking about becoming a member, this is – we're trying to push you toward the phone, obviously. We're trying to get you on that keyboard to go online. However you want to make the donation, it is important. It's acknowledging that you're listening, which means – How does it get to me? Money is involved.
Yes, and you get to determine how much money. We would never want it to be a burden to you if you can't give $1,000 a year. How about this? We are looking for new members joining at the $5 a month level.
What a deal.
You can become a sustaining member at that, and that is really what is the foundation here at Prairie Public. The amount of people who give what sounds like a small amount, because we break it into nice monthly payments, so it's nice and manageable for you, but you get a lot of people pitching in and helping out, and that is what does become $1,000, $2,000, $6,000, what have you, dollars a year, when a lot of people are able to contribute at the just $5 a month level. And don't forget, in addition to all of the programming that you're getting in return, you also have the opportunity to win a night's stay at the Hodo, at the Hotel Donaldson, this great boutique hotel in downtown Fargo. And that drawing will be on Thursday. Every pledge will get entered in that drawing. You don't have to make a donation to do so, but we hope that you will at 1-800-359-4145 or at prairiepublic.org.
Joining us now on Main Street is David Allen. He is a senior consultant for spiritual care with the Benedictine Health System, and he joins us from our Bismarck studio. Ashley Thornburg here with me as well. We're going to talk about a subject we've talked about before.
We absolutely have. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
Thank you for having me.
You are on the show with us today to talk about the St. John's Bible. This is something that we have featured on Main Street a number of times because there was a fairly large exhibition of certain of these folios on display in Moorhead. But for anyone who's not familiar with the St. John's Bible, what is it?
It is the first handwritten Bible in 500 years. Since the beginning of the printing press, no project this large has been done by calligraphers. Not only is it the first handwritten Bible, but it's the first handwritten Bible also in English to be completed in the West, certainly. And it was completed by artistic director Donald Jackson and his staff of scribes and artists from about 1998 to 2012, and so about a 15-year span.
What is the Heritage Edition?
The Heritage Edition is the fine art edition of the St. John's Bible. It is sort of the – if you look at the folios that you saw previously, those that would have been the original. These are the best on-the-market editions that are out there. It's a limited edition. There's about 299, and they come in a set of seven. And so these editions sort of act the folios are more – are pages. These are – consist in a bounded book form.
And this is what you're transporting around?
This is what I'm transporting around. I'm transporting around the two editions of the Gospels and Acts, so two of the 300 editions.
Is there an estimated value for the Heritage Edition? I assume the original's priceless.
I've been told that anywhere from about $150,000 to $350,000. $150,000 for one volume and then $350,000 for all seven.
So are you a little nervous behind the wheel?
Certainly am. Minnesota winters are not very forgiving. there have been some slippery slides along the way. Certainly getting into the Rapid Hills, the Black Hills and the Rapid City area was quite the adventure. It's a little nerve-wracking when what you're carrying is about 10 times the price of your car, but.
Well, there is a viewing in Bismarck. It's underway. Can you kind of describe what opportunities people will have to see the Heritage Edition of the St. John's Bible?
Absolutely. St. Gabriel's Community, located at 580 Coleman Street in Bismarck, they're going to have open houses throughout the time here, consisting probably mostly in the afternoon. Currently, they're having a viewing for their residents at 1 to 3 o'clock, but open to the public. Certainly open to the public from 1 o'clock to 5 p.m. Daily, and then throughout the time as well. They're having special viewings open from May 9th at 2:30 to 4:30, May 12th from 12:30 to 3, and then next Tuesday, May 15th from 6 to 8.
So that's when it's available for the general public to see?
That's right. But I know that they would certainly welcome drop-bys and stop-ins sort of thing.
And is this free and open to the public then? Is there a cost?
There is no cost.
You have been on the road since right around St. Patrick's Day, and you've gone to St. Louis, you've gone to Kansas City, down to Lake of the Ozarks, Mitchell, South Dakota, Dickinson, Garrison, Bismarck. You're going to be on the road through the end of the calendar year. What's been your experience so far in terms of the reaction that you see? I don't know if you go to every single one of these events, but enough to get some reaction from people.
First, people are certainly in awe. I mean, the St. John's Bible, not only the story behind it, but to have the opportunity to really physically touch it, to have it be a part of your own faith journey. The first reaction I get is awesome and inspiring for their own faith life, about what a team of people can do who are dedicated, who are thoughtful, who are creative. And I would say one of the best reactions I've had working with seniors is especially that just their real appreciation to interact with the Bible, to have it be an open, to have the book be open to different illuminations, to be able to page through it. They love sharing that with their families, with their friends, with each other. That faith experience is truly transformed.
You've been on the road with the Bible now for months, and you've got months left ahead of you. How long is this all going to take?
Well, we have 36 care communities across the Midwest. We're looking at having the Heritage Edition be displayed for roughly about 10 days to, 18, to about 2 to 3 weeks, let's say. We're looking at this probably wrapping up in Duluth around Thanksgiving, Christmas time, and then we might have some other exhibits that we'll show. We're only one-third done, completed with the tour. It's been a really exciting time. My job primarily is I'm sort of the travel agent for the Bible. I drop it off. I do some education with the folks here, here in Bismarck, for example. And then I go back to my regular position in the Twin Cities, in the Duluth area, in Duluth, Minnesota, and then I come back for about 2 days and spend time with them, and of course with larger events if they ask me to be present.
And your regular job is senior consultant for spiritual care. How would you describe that job?
I am the chaplain for chaplains, is what I like to say. I'm sort of the support center or corporate voice for we have about 25 chaplains that are professionally employed within our care communities. And I'm sort of their resource, whether that be assisting them with programming, certainly just being an advocate for them, for their voice at the table, and, you know, guiding them for the next steps of what we hope to provide is not only Christian-based, but ecumenical, inspiring Benedictine healthcare.
How does the Heritage Edition of the St. John's Bible or the St. John's Bible in general fit in with the mission of the Benedictine health system?
I would say, you know, Benedictines are all about unity. Unity is such an inspiring they're all about community and unity. And I think the St. John's Bible does that. The fact that we're having the Bible extend throughout our entire health system, it really does foster a sense of community. Well, it's being hosted at one of our communities, but also it's an opportunity for our communities to dialogue with one another, to create a sense of purpose. I love the fact that it's truly honoring all of our sponsoring community, the Sisters of St. Scholastica in Duluth. It allows each community to have that opportunity to offer a sense of gratitude, a sense of thanks for their sponsorship, but also a chance to empower the community to think about what's possible. The St. John's Bible truly is, it's a monumental thing, and it certainly was something that the monks of St. John's didn't have to do. They took a risk. I think that energizes our communities to really think about what are the next steps that we can do as a care community to offer inspirational care for others.
What is happening with the original St. John's Bible? There were those original folio pages on display in Morehead at the M. Combs Center for some time, and we were told that they could only be in that environment for so long, that kind of thing. So how do they protect and store the original St. John's Bible?
If you go to St. John's Abbey and you kind of know the right people, you're actually allowed to go to the vault, the airlock temperature room that, you know, it's kind of like James Bond in a way. They protect it, you know, certainly with high levels of security. There's only a certain group of individuals who have access to this particular room. The Bible does travel around the world. And so those folio pages that you saw in Morehead, you know, may be in London by the fall. They may be in Spain. I know there's an exhibit starting out in Sydney and in Perth, Australia, starting our summer, their winter, in June. And then Hong Kong is having an exhibit in January. So the Bible does travel all around. That's why when you actually even go to St. John's, you might even see those 7 or 8 folios, and they might just be one book of the Bible. With the Heritage Edition, we actually can offer certainly more than 7 pages, almost 200 pages to offer to our seniors. And so that's how we landed on that. But the actual Bible travels all around the world.
Well, you mentioned that there are 200 copies of the Heritage Edition of this Bible. What ultimately happens to them? Will somebody own them? Will there be one on the copy table at Mar-a-Lago or something like that? I mean, they're expensive. Where would they go?
Well, Pope Francis has 2 of them, and so they're in good company for sure. The Library of Congress has 1. But believe it or not, private homes are really – there are people that have it in their private collection. They also have libraries, universities have swept up about 50 copies already. But The largest clientele are libraries, universities, public offices, larger cathedrals and churches across not only the United States but the West. And then I know there's a community – there's a cathedral in Brazil that's looking at the St. John's Bible as an opportunity to be installed within their walls.
I did a number of interviews on the St. John's Bible when it was on display at the Jomkampst, and I heard a lot of reaction, you know, in particular from women who were really praising that it really celebrated the contributions of women. There was a woman from Ethiopia with a young daughter who was excited to see non-white people featured in the Bible. Have you gotten any backlash about this interpretation of the Bible, this translation of the Bible, of being not what some people would like us to believe religion is all about?
What I love about the Bible is that it can meet a whole host of different people on their own personal faith journey. Whether that be I want more diversity within my own understanding of the Bible, or you know, I appreciate this Bible and the effort, but I'll take my own Bible and my own sense of when I read the Bible. Mm. I'll take that home with me. We do get both camps. I would say, you know, the only backlash that I've really seen are people just, you know, uncertain about. We have one illumination that has quite a lot of there's a lot of Hebrew in it. You're not sure how is this Christian based or is this about Jesus? But then you have to think about, wait a minute here. Wait a minute, Jesus was actually a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
So often we have to kind of think about, we have to step back in our faith and just say, wow, the church is much bigger than maybe our own hometown or our own interpretation. We actually are a global church.
One of the quaint features of the St. John's Bible, this illuminated version, first one in hundreds of years, was that there were corrections that had to be made. And it's kind of artful the way they were done. Are those same corrections replicated in this Heritage Edition?
Absolutely. They are. I'm thinking about just the second page of Mark, for example. There's a beautiful illumination of Jesus as a farmer. He's wearing his blue jeans, a modern take at Jesus, and he's planting the seed onto the word. Well, one of the scribes, he or she missed a line while they were writing out the text. And so to assist them, there's a little bird eating the seed and the illumination, and then there's another bird sort of carrying that addition, that mistake, on sort of a banner. And as it's meeting its friend, it's really lovely. It's absolutely lovely.
Can you take us back to the first time that you took in the St. John's Bible? What was your reaction, and how did it change or enhance or inform your faith journey?
Sure. I was about 16 years old. I'm 32 now. And so I was there pretty much about 2002 is when I saw – 2003 is when I saw the first illuminations. This would have been really the early years of Donald Jackson's work. The final project wasn't completed until 2012. And so we were just sort of seeing the beginning illuminations. What I love, it's the illuminations that I'm sharing with our residents today. Really my first reaction, you know, coming at, as a teenager, not really sure what this was all about. I knew a little bit about monks, but I thought that monks were just people that wrote the Bible, that they copied the Bible and they prayed and they lived at St. John's. Little did I know that, you know, that community that sponsored the St. John's Bible would be probably the greatest support and place of love that I've ever had in my life, personally. It would really change who I am as an individual and also my own vocational calling as a monastic member of that community, joining in 2011.
Well, the Heritage Edition of the St. John's Bible will be available for viewing at St. Gabriel's Community. That's at 4580 Coleman Street in North Bismarck, the viewing through May 15th. And David Allen is taking it on to other places as well. David, thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dozens of people working tirelessly to create something What does that St. John's Bible effort remind you of?
A little bit of Prairie Public, isn't it?
It sounds exactly like how Prairie Public works. We need a lot of people to do a little bit of effort and make this possible. Be a part of something bigger than yourself when you contribute at 1-800-359-4145 or click and join online at prairiepublic.org, or you can text the number 484848 and just make sure that you text it the word support and you'll get a link and follow along and do it nice, easy on your smartphone.
Now, one of the steps you might take on your way to that phone or the keyboard is to say, how much do I want to give to Prairie Public? And, you know, there's no number we throw out there that is the set number. This isn't the membership required number. We'll go to $5 a month as a sustainer. That's 60 bucks a year. That's a latte a month. And you are supporting what you're listening to right now. And we'll also send you, if you want to come in at 5 bucks a month as a sustainer, that's 60 bucks a year again, you'll get the Prairie Public Water Tumbler. That's our thank you gift, because we do want to thank you for becoming a member. We hope as a sustaining member you'll be with us for some time to come and help sustain Prairie Public for those people down the road who, you know, might want to think about becoming members too. It's easy to do. 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org, or that 21st century magical thing where you take your smartphone and you type support to 484848. Very quick, very easy.
It absolutely is easy, but don't think that that doesn't mean it's not important. It is absolutely crucial, the support that comes from membership. It is, frankly, the biggest single piece of the budget. You know, we've all had to tighten belts here and there, and maybe you stop going out to 2 movies a month and you cut back to 1 movie a month or what have you. That is something that is a real concern here at Public Broadcasting, only it's not don't go to 1 movie. It might be maybe we don't carry that show anymore. Ooh, now is the time to support your favorite shows when you call 1-800-359-4145 or click and join online at prairiepublic.org.
We will remind you throughout the hour that it's easy to do. It's also essential. It's very important. These membership drives sustain what you're listening to. Prairie Public is public because of you. So that's why we're talking to you. Well, coming up on Main Street, we'll hear from the Quilters Guild organizer from the Fargo area. That's Virginia Dambach. They're having a big Metro Quilt Expo this weekend. And we'll also hear from a couple of folks who've been all over the world, and now they're writing essays on how to think globally and act locally. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Water quality testing is underway in the Devil's Lake area as crews look to start operating outlet pumps for the season. Devil's Lake Basin Joint Water Resource Board Manager Jeff Frith says even with our delayed spring, the runoff across the Devil's Lake Basin has been low, resulting in a quarter to half foot increase in the lake level.
It's really quite down from, you know, comparison over the past 25 years since we started going up this journey. You know, our average lake level increase was around that 200,000 acre foot of increase. This year we may end up with, you know, somewhere between that 30 and 70,000 acre foot of inflows for the spring.
Frith says the lake's west end outlet is being tested, which could lead to the start of the 2018 pumping season sometime this week. Frith says there were some slow points last season due to high sulfate levels, but they were still able to take 140,000 acre feet of water off the lake and reach a new milestone.
We hit 1 million acre feet of water removed from the lake since the pump started operation in 2005.
Frith says without the outlets in place, Devil's Lake would be roughly 5 1/2 feet higher than it is today. He says the lower lake level also means good things for the agricultural community as land gets re-exposed and put back into production. The Moorhead City Council is trying to determine how to pay for the railroad underpass at the intersection of Main and 20th and 21st Street South after bids came in at $7 million over budget, raising the total cost of the long, sought-after project to more than $65 million. Moorhead City Engineer Bob Zimmerman told council members there are several options to consider in order to make up the gap. That includes seeking additional state funding in the bonding bill. State lawmakers have already approved more than $42 million for the project. Another would be to use municipal state aid funds or rely on special assessments that could range from $775 to $1,550.
The assessment district now essentially goes from on the north, roughly 8th Avenue North, on the south, roughly 12th Avenue South, and on the east, Ditch 47, on the west, the river. So it's a relatively large area, includes approximately 3,500 properties.
Zimmerman says the city is also talking with the contractor, looking at possible changes to the project that could lower the cost. He says there will be better information once the legislature wraps up, and that by May 29th council meeting, they should be able to decide whether to proceed with the project or rebid. That would set the project back until next year and could increase the cost. And the Minnesota House is moving forward with a proposed state constitutional amendment for transportation funding. Supporters want to have Minnesota voters decide in November whether to dedicate existing sales tax revenue from auto parts and repairs to road and bridge projects. Republican Representative Paul Torkelson chairs the House Transportation Committee. He says the bill has strong support.
Well, there's certainly a strong coalition, a variety of groups and interest groups that are very much in favor of this work. And the truth is we all depend on the road system to get us to school or to the nursing home or to the hospital.
But the Senate's version of the measure may have stalled. Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka says he doesn't have the votes needed to pass it. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Joining us on Main Street is Virginia Dambach. She is the publicity chair for the Quilters Guild of North Dakota. The Metro Quilt Expo is this Friday and Saturday at the Fargo Ramada, Friday from 9 to 6 and Saturday from 9 to 5. Thanks for being with us, Virginia.
Thank you so much.
What is the Quilters Guild?
The Quilters Guild is a nonprofit organization made up of people who quilt and people who appreciate quilts.
So how many members do you have?
Approximately 300.
Wow.
And we spend a lot of time, especially in the winter, designing pieces and making pieces. And, of course, this is our opportunity to show them off.
So is this an individual craft and art, or is this a group craft and art?
Well, it can be both. It's primarily individual, except we do have a number of neighborhood groups and groups that emphasize a specific aspect of quilting. So there are friendship block groups where you make blocks for each other to get a big quilt. There's round robin groups where you take one block and then pass it around and each person makes it bigger and bigger. And there's the general meetings where we get together once a month for show and tell.
Well, besides the expo this Friday and Saturday at the Fargo Ramada, there will be lots of quilts to see, I'm assuming.
There will be lots of quilts.
And there will be demonstrations as well?
Demonstrations. We've got Mennonite plush work, English paper piecing, doodle quilting, needle felting, and crazy quilting will all be demonstrated. And then we also have scheduled lectures, everything from what the judge is looking for to what's in my button box. And we have Kay Watson from Minot, who's a button collector. And she will show special buttons from her collection, but she's also inviting members of the public and the Quilters Guild to bring their favorite buttons and find out about them, what's the history, what's the value. So that's going to be really good.
Well, as a layman, like I would say, you're a heck of a quilter. You brought in a square, that a wall-hanging quilt that you're working on. We can't show it on the radio, but I can describe it as saying it looks a lot like real roses.
Roses made of ribbon and cotton, little petals on a string, and I've used some ribbon in it. There are so many techniques, and they'll all be on display. Everything from very traditional to very contemporary. We also have, for the first time, a special exhibit of the Surface Design Association swatch collection. And it's 12-inch squares, and they demonstrate and show every kind of technique from applique to an embroidery and needle felting and embellishment and beading and shibori dyeing. And unlike the rest of the quilt show, you're actually invited to touch them. Well, yeah, that is a biggie.
So what are judges looking for when they are judging quilts?
Creativity and technique. Control of that technique, points that match, binding that's full and carefully sewn down, color choices, symmetry. The judge we have, Kate Elkema, she's a certified quilt judge, and she examines every quilt, looks at the stitches front and back, and makes a decision. And she gives very good comments on the quilts, what she likes, what she didn't like, what you need to improve, what you did really well. It's very constructive.
Is there a history or an origin story about quilting?
With quilting, there's a difference between patchwork and appliqué, which is the top. And
which is
quilting,
what I always think about,
right,
yeah.
Quilting is the three layers, the back, the middle padding, and the top layer. The earliest was discovered in China in way, way, way back in the deep history. Mm-hmm. And it was quilted armor.
So the layered look protected you.
The layered look protected you. So that is the first discovered quilt. In patchwork, often thought to have begun in the United States. In England, they did whole cloth quilts and also broderie purse applique chintz quilts. But patchwork, we think, started here. But I can find someone who's much better at quilt history for you.
How did you get involved with the Guild?
When Bob and I moved here, when we
Bob
were...
Bob Dambach, the director of television for Prairie Public.
When we moved here, we were interviewing for jobs, and we were staying at the Holiday Inn, and we walked across the street to West Acres, and they were having a quilt show. And I had just started quilting, and I turned to Bob and said, "Oh, honey, look, they've got a quilt guild. Let's move here." And we did.
Okay.
And I went to my first meeting when it was 86 below zero, and we couldn't leave the car running, so Bob had to deliver me and pick me up.
But thank heaven you were making quilts.
Yes, and it's, you know, I've made lifelong friendships and grown as an artist and a quilter by being around other quilters. And that's what we hope to do with the show, is inspire people who maybe have never shown a quilt to show their quilt, to bring their family and friends. Share the joy of quilting.
Virginia Dambach is the publicity chair for the Quilters Guild of North Dakota. The Metro Quilt Expo is this Friday and Saturday at the Fargo Ramada, Friday from 9 to 6 and Saturday from 9 to 5.
Right.
Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Doug.
I love listening with my children so they can listen to unbiased news.
I love the accurate reporting on the nation in North Dakota. And Stardate is how I know I have left the house on time or not.
The Saturday shows have been a part of my life for over 30 years. I especially like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, This American Life, and Reveal.
I've had the pleasure of experiencing the warm, welcoming nature of Prairie Public as an organization, hands-on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For supporting Prairie Public.
Yes, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to hear those familiar voices from Prairie Public, the people I work with, my colleagues, reading those comments from listeners who, you know, might, as they submit their membership, offer some ideas or some words of encouragement or, you know, some reflection about what they hear. We really like to hear from our members. We like to hear from listeners about what they like and, for that matter, what they don't like. So membership is an opportunity for us to remind you that this is public radio. It's interactive. It's not just money. It's ideas. Give us a call at 800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848. For those of you who have done that, thank you.
And joining us now on Main Street is Pastor Mudende. He is an artist, and Alexandre Cusa, who is a community liaison with Folkways. Pastor, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having us. Yeah.
Alex, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, merci beaucoup for having us.
We are having you on today because an article that the two of you are writing, or a series of articles, I should say, in Fargo Monthly magazine, is called Think Globally, Act Locally. What inspired this series of columns?
So I was fortunate, an older brother slash mentor named Greg Tavin, in December 2016, we visited and he said, "Hey, I see you doing a lot of things in downtown and in the community in general. What can I do to help you do more?" And I basically said, "Hey, Greg, I don't know if you could help me maybe share some of my ideas with the public. I don't know how." And that's where he said, "Oh, I should connect you to the Fargo Monthly. You visit with some of their editors and we'll see what comes from your meeting with them." And that's when in January 2017, so a month after that, I had met with them already. They said, you know, let's try it out, write an article, and we'll see how it goes. And my first article with the Fargo Monthly was The 5 Reasons Why I'm Still in Fargo. And from there was I started writing every other month. And after, you know, writing several times, at some point an editor, Erica, she told me, hey, you know, I like what you're writing, but we should maybe have a column name. Let's see of a recurring kind of title for your column. And it was an honor. I was like, oh, my God, that means I'm becoming a columnist or whatever. So I was pretty excited. And then from there, I was like, what can I have? Something not too cliche, but at the same time that speaks to a broader audience. And I thought, I've lived different places, but currently my home away from home is Fargo. Morehead, to be precise, on the exotic side of the Red River. And that's where, yeah, I thought, you know what? Think globally, act locally. So with the different places I've lived, I can bring a global perspective in a humble way because I haven't lived everywhere. But then trying to implement it locally and act locally. And by sharing some of my ideas, I hope to encourage people to think sometime outside of the FM area to bring some local solution to our sometimes global problems. And that's where recently I was like, hey, my older brother from another Rwandan mother, I know you're awesome and you have a magic brushstroke and you have a lot of ideas. Would you mind jumping on this column to share some of your insightful, artistic, pristine ideas? And now I'm going to pass it to Pastor.
Oh, yes. Alex approached me with this. He didn't approach me, actually. I kept on bugging him for a while. I kept on telling him for a long time when I lived in New York, I used to have this blog. I called it Voice Motion. And I was pretty much doing this artistic cool hunting where I would find the most underrated artists, whether was it musicians and anybody. And kind of write little articles about them and give them this a little nod of recognition on what they were doing. But when Alex started writing, I'm like, oh my God, I used to love doing this. Maybe I should try hard and see if I can join him. And one day he's like, yeah, man, let's do it. And yeah, and I came in and saw the first article, which is the only one that we wrote. It was called How to Support Local Art, because I'm a local artist. And so I felt maybe we should shine a light on how you can actually really support artists. It was a really, I think, a beautiful article written.
Well, and between the two of you, when we want to talk about thinking globally, living like global citizens, between the two of you, you've lived in Rwanda and France and Guinea and Ethiopia and Switzerland and New York and San Francisco and Reno. You really have your bona fides here. Just a definition for someone who really is a global citizen. What does that really mean? Because a lot of people just think it means being aware that other countries exist, and that's not enough.
Yes. So I believe the name of the column itself, Think Global, Act Local, it brings up this idea of being a global citizen. Actually, like we're used to seeing globalization as something maybe you see on your TV screen, but right now globalization is in our street, is in the grocery store. So like, we're trying to bring out this essence on how do we create and reimagine how all these sorts of culture, because now this, like let's say the city of Fargo is not a one-size-fits-all. It has a lot of different places. We have different restaurants. Some are very spicy. Some are just local hamburger places. And so how do we bring together the embodiment and the awareness of these all sorts of different cultures in one place?
So what are some of your favorite ways to think globally but act locally, and especially ones that people might not think of?
So interestingly enough, when I came in 2010, every time when I introduce myself, I say I'm from Rwanda. However, I was born in Rwanda because my mom worked for the UN. So I've lived around different countries, like you just said. So I remember the people I could connect with automatically, the more domestic student, were the military kids that were same, were like, yeah, I'm from, they would say, a place, but because of mom or dad's work, we moved around a lot. So now I'm somewhat, home is everywhere, and at the same time, nowhere. Yeah. So that's why I started thinking, there's even an actual book that in the mid-50s/60s called Third Culture Kids, where basically talked about kids of missionaries and maybe military kids that maybe didn't live in the U.S., so let's say grew up in Guam or more on Germany, let's say, on a Germany military American base. When they were in Germany, they were like, oh, you're American. And I would, okay, sure. When they came to the U.S., well, you didn't grow up here. You're more from Germany. So that's how the third bubble came, is like, I'm a third culture kid where almost everywhere is my home now. And usually being a global citizen to me is any community you are in, you have some kind of set of things you want to meet to say that's his home. A good group of friends, and you know they say friends are the family you choose. I was told this once. And then you say, I'm going to maybe join a place, I want to volunteer or do something, find a cause I can try to make an impact with, and maybe start sharing some of the fruit salad of cultures I've accumulated over the years. So to me, it's more of anywhere you go, you start going through that mini list, if I may say, and it's basically being at home almost everywhere. That's, to me, being a global citizen. So even when I have friends that are from smaller towns and they move now to Fargo, first they were like, I'm from a small town, and now I'm in Fargo. But now they're like, I'm actually from Fargo. I still remember my small town. But so for me, that's also being a global citizen, the capacity of embracing any culture you are first in contact with, going through, again, that mini list of items you want to check to say, yes, 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 this is my new home away from home.
Pastor, in your article, you call for cities and towns to have art as a second language, and art and music are often sort of described as universal languages. Yeah. What does that mean to you, to have a city speak art?
So the beauty about that is that artists usually create and reimagine in terms of reality. In cities where art is embraced, where art is actually the main focus, those cities become usually way better off. I can imagine living in New York City, there was never a night where I couldn't find something to do. There was always an opening at an art gallery. There was always a play somewhere. And art, because it has always been a very big part of me growing up. I remember working in Nairobi when I was very young, and I would look through windows of these art galleries and see this tiny African art, these little silhouettes that are made by Nairobi artists. And I just never seen something so much fine, and that spoke to me so much. Mm-hmm. And so it brought me into this essence of trying to be the artist who brings out the culture into the city.
Alex, I've seen on some of your comment articles and social media posting talking about this Ubuntu perspective on life and various translations that say it means human kindness, or I am what I am because who we all are, or I am because you are. People argue that it stresses the collective over the individual. Americans tend to stress the individual over the collective. And then when you're here in the Midwest, there's this stoicism too. What was your first reaction to that? Was it difficult to get used to that?
It's a great question. I think I always told people that the reason I'm still in Fargo is because of the community. It's not the weather. It's not the horizon infinity landscape. It's the people. And I almost even said that the harsh cold is balanced out by the warmth of the community. So it's interesting when you see the Midwest or Fargo-Moorhead, where it's overall individual kind of culture, but at the same time very community-oriented. When there was the flood, I was told the community saved Fargo. It was not, you know, it's the community that rolled up their sleeve and saved Fargo. Therefore, for me at first was, okay, still individual, people like their space. You know, they don't trespass my space. But I would say that overall people have been very warm and supportive and welcoming. However, when I bring in now the Ubuntu that is shared in a lot of languages and culture that are in sub-equatorial Africa, I would say that it's that extension of humanity you see in someone. So usually if you're in pain, I feel your pain. If you're happy, I feel your happiness. But as well, I know that if I'm the one that could cause you to be in pain or to be hurt in a way, I should also do my best to rectify this. And I think in a tumultuous time or time of frictions, because the Fargo-Moorhead's demographic has been changing rapidly, I think that's why I always brought it back to Ubuntu. If you say, well, you said yellow and I said orange. No, we're all saying a color and we're all trying to bring our colors to the table. And that's why we should always think the bigger picture, think globally, act locally, and think, hey, what is, as humans, what is beneficial to both of us? Having a safe community, having a community that is welcoming to everyone. So me just always inviting people to go at the core of our humanity that bonds us rather than surface thing that divides us.
Well, I look forward to seeing more of those themes developed in the articles, Thinking Globally, Acting Locally. They are published monthly in Fargo Monthly Magazine. Pastor Mudende is an artist. Thank you for joining us today. Yeah. And Alexandre Cusa is a community liaison with Folkways. Thank you for joining us
merci
today.
Merci beaucoup.
Thank you.
Thinking globally and acting locally, that's kind of what we're asking our listeners to do
right now.
Yes,
absolutely. And if you heard that last comment talking about the life philosophy of Ubuntu, that I am because you are, well, that's exactly what Prairie Public, you know, we fit that. We are here because of you, because of your contributions, because of your efforts. And in any sort of financial help that you are able to donate, rest assured that it will be put to good use, bringing you programming that you enjoy and that, frankly, we think you deserve to hear. High quality, in-depth, thoughtful, engaging programming. You hear from diverse voices. We hear from across the state, the nation, internationally. Do you think that's cheap to put out there? No. Listen, if you've ever stopped buying cheap shoes and started buying expensive shoes and then noticed your feet didn't hurt so much anymore, well, it's kind of the same way when it comes to news production. You get what you pay for, and you are investing in quality programming. When you call 1-800-359-4145 or donate at prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848.
As you probably noticed, we don't run any commercials. We do remind you occasionally, a couple times through the year, that we are relying on you to support this effort. This is public radio. It's Prairie Public. It's your public radio. If you're in North Dakota or Western Minnesota or Northern South Dakota or Eastern Montana, this is your signal. You're listening to it. Get invested in it. If you're not a member yet, think about that very seriously, because it isn't some miracle that gets this to you. It's people like you who have made the step to become members. It's easy to do. It's a phone call away. It's an online keyboard address away. It's a text away. It's 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org, or you text 484848 with the word support. And for those of you who have done that, thank you. The rest of you, please think about it now.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 8th. North Dakota remembers World War I. In the spring of 1918, with the war raging in France, another battle was playing out in the political landscape of North Dakota. In a few short years, the Nonpartisan League, led by Arthur C. Townley, had taken control of state government. Tired of big business and big money making the laws, Townley was able to launch a successful farmers' revolt in the 1914 elections, and he increased his power in the elections of 1916. In the 1917 legislative session, the NPL introduced House Bill 44, an authorization to rewrite the state constitution. Although it easily passed in the House, a more cautious Senate laid it on the table and it stalled. An unsuccessful attempt to revive this bill was made during a special session the following year. If the bill was to pass, it would have given Townley and his supporters the opportunity to revise the Constitution to make it better reflect their socialistic philosophy. At the same time, the NPL was coming under fire for their anti-war propaganda, and many national NPL leaders were banned from speaking in towns across the state. With North Dakota boys dying on the battlefields in France, this new anti-war rhetoric was dimming the luster of the organization, and the strong farmer support was beginning to waver. On May 1st, a new organization was created in Minot called the Lincoln Republican League. Composed of stalwart members of a somewhat dismantled Republican Party, they joined with three other groups, the State Legislative Campaign Committee, the Independent Political Association, and the North Dakota Farmers League. The League had but one objective in mind. George Somms of Crosby put it this way: "In this city, 3 years ago, was born the movement which has placed the state in the hands of irresponsible men. We have come back to Minot to end that movement. The Nonpartisan League was born here, and it is proper that we should bury it where the cradle stood." On this date in 1918, the Lincoln Republican League was meeting in Jamestown, where N.T. Hedelin was elected chairman, Theodore Coffle, secretary, and John E. Davis, treasurer. They organized into districts and began selecting candidates for the upcoming elections. To unify the organization, and some say to reach across the aisle to Democrats, a new name was chosen. Now known as the Independent Voters Association, it began an uphill battle to defeat the still powerful Nonpartisan League. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jim Davis. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Dakota Datebook is one of our more popular podcast options. A lot of people like that little look back in North Dakota history. And podcasts, you know, just another way that we are putting content out there, because we have to adapt to the times, adapt with the listeners. All of that is made possible with your membership support. When you call 1-800-359-4145 and donate what is comfortable within your budget, you are supporting the variety of programming on the variety of platforms that we have available here at Prairie Public. 800-359-4145.
Wednesday on Main Street, we'll hear about Public Radio's StoryCorps visit to Bismarck. Associate Director Danielle Anderson will explain how you can reserve a StoryCorps spot to record a conversation with a loved one. And we'll feature another Governor's Travel and Tourism Award winner. Gallery Director Noah Dobmeyer will join us to talk about the Red Door Gallery in Wahpeton. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.